Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of Puerto Rico and the economy. We're kicking it off by talking about coverage of the budget. For the fourth time in 2 months, Congress passed a government spending bill with no protections for dreamers. And that means that the fate of almost 700,000 young undocumented people who were brought to the United States as children remains in limbo. Joining us to talk about coverage is Julio Ricardo Valera, digital media director for Futuro Media, contributor to Latino USA, and co-host of In the Thick. Hi, Julio. Welcome back to the show. Good. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks. It's Dayan.
Dayan. I'm sorry. I always get that wrong. Thank you, David. David Dayan. Well, before we dive in and talk about the economy, let's first start off talking about news that stood out for both of you. We always like to start off on a positive note. David, what grabbed your attention this week?
Well, I think I have to give it to my Intercept colleague, Ryan Grimm, for really breaking and moving forward the story about Rob Porter, the White House staff secretary, who was let go this week after reports of domestic violence in his past. This is, impact journalism. It doesn't get any more than that, and I know Ryan worked hard on that story, so I'd like to shout him out.
You know, David, just quickly, because there's so much going on, it is hard to pay attention to all of these issues. Can you just give us an overview of what happened here?
Right. So Rob Porter is the staff secretary of the White House, and it turned out there was a longstanding FBI investigation into his past of domestic violence against two separate wives. The reason this is important is that the staff secretary really is the one who delivers important papers and communications to the president. And because of this past, Porter was not able to get a security clearance from the FBI because they thought he could be compromised since this lurking in his past had the potential of coming up. And so we had this situation where the staff secretary to the White House didn't have security clearance, which is, almost mandatory for his job, and it shows, more of the chaos and dysfunction within the White House. And then, of course, John Kelly, the chief of staff, who covered for Mr. Porter, has been diminished sort of, among the press and this idea that they were covering for an abuser. And then it came out later that this has been known about for close to a year. So it was my colleague who really kicked this set of reporting off, and I just want to salute.
And as you say, according to many reports, a number of senior White House officials, including John Kelly, knew for months that the FBI heard from testimony from Porter's ex-wives about abuse, verbal and physical abuse, and that contradicted Kelly's account that he was not, quote, fully aware of the abuse until this week.
That's correct. And you sort of never know when certain stories are really going to, shine a brighter light on what is happening, in the corridors of power. But this one certainly did.
All right. So kudos to your colleagues, Ryan Grimm and Aline Brown, for their piece. Former wives of top White House aide Rob Porter both told FBI he abused them. And that is David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept. What about you, Julio? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I was in D.C. during the whole shutdown debate. And one of the things that caught my attention that didn't really get a lot of attention while everyone was focusing on Nancy Pelosi's 8-hour marathon speech in favor of DACA recipients and dreamers, that the actual community that she was addressing was kind of skeptical about her words and actually told her, you know, you can talk all you want. Are you going to show up on Thursday and lead this vote against the CR spending bill and speak for the DREAM Act? And there was a lot of, you know, this is what I mean. You know, when you see someone like Pelosi on mainstream television, it's being seen as this, you know, courage, and it's the eight-hour talk, and she's standing up for immigrants. But everyone I spoke to in D.C. on Wednesday and Thursday in the immigrants' rights community were incredibly skeptical. They saw it as a political ploy and just political operative and optics. And I think there's this sense in the immigrants' rights community that it's just such an exasperation. They kind of know what Republicans do. They know they're not going to get anything from Republicans, but they're kind of also looking at the Democratic Party again and kind of saying, I don't know if I don't know if all sectors of the Democratic Party have our best interests. And I think the Pelosi speaking on 8 hours and then voting against the CR bill but not leading other Democrats to vote with her on Thursday, there's a lot of disappointment, there's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of exhaustion. And the problem is that this community does not get the voice, and it's always like, let's focus on the big shiny debate and let's forget that, you know, every day lives are being impacted. And just being on the ground in D.C., this is not some organized Democrat organization doing all this. There's plenty of first-time, you know, politically active people who are undocumented who are coming to D.C. from all parts of the country because they believe, like, this issue matters. And it's just been, anyone who's following it would know, but it feels like it's gotten so simplified that it needs to get more attention, that angle.
Can you elaborate on that, Julio? Because, I mean, my Twitter feed yesterday was just full of people praising Nancy Pelosi, saying that she spoke for, what was it, almost 8 hours in high heels. And that was, for some reason, in every single tweet. So you were in D.C. talking to Dreamers. What did they tell you?
They really, like I said, I don't know if people know, but the one organization, United We Dream, on Thursday, and I was there in the congressional building. So when you come into the entrance into the congressional building, the first, like, one of the entrances, Pelosi's office is the first one on the left amongst all the Democrats. And there was about, at the time, I saw about 20, 30 undocumented youth and allies in her office, basically doing a speak-a-thon for 8 hours about their stories. What they were calling for, what these youth and their allies were calling for, is it's even happened with someone like Chuck Schumer or Dick Durbin. They're hearing a lot of talk about DACA and the DREAM Act and how important it is, but there hasn't been anything concrete since September. Everything gets kicked down the road, and so for them to be skeptical of institutional Democrats, And for people to at least understand that and not actually be lambasted, because I think one of the problems that comes out of this is that if you report what people are saying, and if you're saying this is coming from the undocumented rights community, from young people, from young dreamers, and I report it, and at the same time, you know, the messengers, the reporters get lambasted because it's like, but it's Trump, you're fighting against Trump. Like, it's not as simple as the political media is presenting this issue. And the moment we have a real discussion with real dreamers at the table, that they become part of the national conversation, they do not become a political bargaining chip, the debate will move forward. But right now, at the same time, there's a lot of people who are going through severe mental health issues. They don't know what their lives are going to... I mean, I talk to people who have jobs and job permits who are like, I might lose my job in 3 weeks. I don't even know what's going to happen. So I think that conversation is being lost in this entire bigger political discussion.
It's such a good point, because we did a show last week about DACA recipients and TPS recipients. We had three women immigrants on, and they all said that they are so tired of the media coverage that just focuses on politicians and academics.
Right.
And that they don't give a voice, or the microphone, I should say, to immigrants. And when they do, they can often be patronizing. David, Dan, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I feel like Schumer and I guess to a lesser extent Pelosi, kind of stumbled into this at the urging of these young dreamers without really any sense of how they were going to manage the situation. You certainly saw that with the first shutdown, mm-hmm. which ended super abruptly. And now you're seeing it with the bipartisan deal that was passed, you know, early this morning, without DACA really even coming up on the agenda. And I feel like if certainly the House Democrats had the ability to stop this deal, if they really wanted to force some sort of decision-making process on DACA, and not enough of them did. Obviously, they gave the margin of victory for this bipartisan deal. So if it was really the number one priority, that's not something that would have happened. So certainly the Dreamer community has to think about that in terms of, you know, who their allies truly are.
And Capitol Police arrested immigrant rights activists who held a nonviolent civil disobedience action inside the Senate rotunda yesterday.
Right.
What can you both tell us about the politics? I mean, Julio, what are you mm-hmm. hearing from Democratic staffers about the politics behind this?
The politics are behind it. I mean, what you're seeing, to be honest with you, is, you know, everyone says the Republican Party is trying to figure itself out, but not many people are looking at the Democratic side. And what I'm seeing, and this has been a consistent message, this is not coming out of yesterday. I mean, people tend to forget that under the Democratic administration of Barack Obama in the early years, this country experienced the most number of ICE arrests and detentions in the history of this country, in addition to record deportations. So this is not coming out of, like, you know, this is not like something that doesn't have a history. And it's always been the uncomfortable truth that the Democratic Party has yet to grapple with. Anyone, like, they say they stand with Dreamers, but when I talk to the Dreamer community, and this is consistent, I'm talking about people that have been in this movement for close to 10 years. They were started, you know, someone like Erica Andiola, who worked in the Sanders campaign, she was 21 years old as an undocumented rights activist. I mean, they're turning 30 now.
Mm.
So this is, there's this skepticism, there's this, and especially with young Dreamers, especially with people that, younger people that are in contact with Dreamers who are politically engaged, they see the voices like Schumer and Pelosi and Durbin as not, it's not being courageous. They don't see their world becoming a priority, and they've been in this rodeo before with President Obama when he promised comprehensive immigration reform, when he had a democratically controlled Congress. They couldn't pass the DREAM Act. In 2010, 5 Democrats voted against the DREAM Act. So that truth is in people's faces, and it's really hard for Democrats to have serious conversations about it. Although I think, because DACA and immigration now has become such a central issue in this debate, I mean, that's what everyone was talking about in Washington, that something's going to happen. And it's, I think it's a soul searching for the Democratic Party again.
David, what would you add to that?
Well, I think if you want to look at this as with sort of a larger lens, over the last year, the Democratic Party has kind of defined themselves in opposition to Donald Trump. That you know, resistance was the order of the day, and that started to wane. I mean, it certainly started to wane in terms of the U.S. Senate putting together this deal and sort of shunting the DACA situation aside. They are largely acceding to these demands, whether it's for much higher military spending, as long as we get some higher non-defense discretionary spending. The problem is that this was sort of definitional for Democrats. Democrats don't really have a story that they've been telling in the last year about the nation they want to see, other than they don't want to see Donald Trump's vision
America
come forward. And if you take that away, there's nothing left. And I think, you know, we've seen poll numbers for Democrats kind of wane in the last several weeks. And I think that, you know, the inability to really have a sort of definitional stance like, you know, this particular issue would be is a big part of that.
Mm. We're going to talk about Puerto Rico in a minute. But Julio, overall, what are your thoughts about how the media are covering DACA and the deportations have been shocking? I mean, it's hard to even keep up with what's happening. Here in San Francisco, a man, Caleb Aring, who is an immigration attorney, talked about bringing his client to an asylum interview just yesterday. He said that the things that happened there were totally unprecedented. This is a man from Sudan. He eventually was arrested. He said this has never happened before. And then I wanted to give kudos to Democracy Now! For having on a New Yorker writer, Sarah Stillman, who has a piece called When Deportation is a Death Sentence. And she and her students at the Columbia Journalism Review are keeping track of the people who are deported and then who are killed in their home countries. This is something the U.S. government does not keep track of. And the stories are shocking. So what are your thoughts about how the media overall
covering this? I think the point about, because we live in a Trump world, and I've said this plenty of times, you couldn't have a Donald Trump if you didn't have a Bill Clinton or a George Bush or a Barack Obama. In terms of, we tend to forget that the criminalization of immigration actually started in 1996, and that we've created this process in a post 9/11 world to have an enforcement. It's basically an enforcement strategy. So, yes, the stories that are coming out. I've talked to several lawyers. You know, I've been following the case of Robbie Rugbeer in New York. That, you know, asylum hearings aren't happening. People are getting, you know, they go to their routine ICE check-in, which they've been doing, and then they get arrested and detained. And yes, there are more and more common stories. But I also believe, and, you know, being one of the few journalists that were writing these stories up during the Obama administration, that this, to suggest that this is just some new thing, it's got a bigger lens because of Trump. I think That for sure, and yes, are the policies that are coming out of the Trump administration in the immigrant rights community, there's no one saying, wow, you know, they're pretty reasonable. They're not. But we're doing ourselves a disservice if we just assume that this happened starting in 2016 when there's plenty of data, there's plenty of stories that, you know, like I said before, ICE detentions had reached record highs in 2010, 2011. So that's why I think you see the immigrants' rights community being incredibly scared, being incredibly frustrated, don't knowing what their life's going to be, and being skeptical of anyone who talks about immigration.
Mm. It's a great point, because Sarah Stillman, in her piece for The New Yorker, points out that a number of these people were murdered, deported and murdered under Obama, in some cases deported for minor traffic violations.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, I know that we have to let you go in about 10 minutes, but let's talk about Puerto Rico before we let you go, because, David's on the full hour. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were leaving us early.
You can have me go if you want.
No. Sorry. I got it mixed up.
It's all good.
All right. So, well, then, since we're not letting David go, Julio, you have to go at 10:30. Is there anything else? Where do you think the media should be focusing right now, given that so much is moving so quickly?
In terms of the politics of immigration?
Yes.
I think the real focus has to be on the human cost. I really think that I think you also have to have strong critiques of political media. I can't watch mainstream cable news media when it comes to immigration anymore. It is so simplified that it misses out the context. Like, for example, you have the President of the United States talking about MS-13. The myth of the criminal gang member alien, and associating that with every dreamer that's walking through, you know, that's around, that, you know, we're being overrun by criminal immigrants. But we don't take the time as an American society and as journalists to say, you know, the cause of a gang like that came because people fled a civil war in the 80s in Central America, and it started and those type of gangs started in California and in Los Angeles. We're a product of our own policy, and the fact that Americans don't look at themselves critically, don't look at themselves contextually and historically, and then all of a sudden it's easy to paint this criminality. And you allow the corporate media, I mean, that they allow this to happen. And so my voice is, I can't get on these shows anymore because I think I speak too much truth.
Wow. Well, you, yeah, I mean,
I think
what you say is completely right on. When it comes to, let's talk about Puerto Rico, because I know we have to let you go in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Give us the latest on what's happening. There were some videos of people who are getting their electricity back, but at this point, do 400,000 people still, they still don't have electricity?
Yes, yes. And let me give you all the headlines of what's happened in Puerto Rico the last couple of weeks. So, yes, about 27 to 30% of customers, of people, still lack electricity, about 400,000 people, for sure. At the same time, the governor of Puerto Rico called for a privatization move for the electric utility PREPA, which is under severe debt, severe mismanagement, has a history of political cronyism. I'm not going to complicate it any more than that. At the same time, the governor of Puerto Rico also called for privatization of charter schools and vouchers. While public schools don't have power and are being shut down in Puerto Rico, there's this push for privatization. The death count is still an issue. The government of Puerto Rico will not release any data updated to the death count, and I've been on this show before, and I've talked about that. And you know, there's plenty of documentation that I've reported with the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico, New York Times, CNN, that there were 1,000 more deaths that happened the 40 days after Maria in 2017 when compared to the 40 days in 2016. The government of Puerto Rico has yet to provide updated information. They haven't updated it since January 4th. And the Center for Investigative Journalism, which partners with Latino USA, sued the government of Puerto Rico on Wednesday to start giving real data. So, and FEMA, there was in CBS News, people like see David Begnon's piece today, there was a contractor that from Atlanta who didn't even have employees, who subcontracted, got a $100 million, whatever, you know, in the hundred millions of dollars of contract for 30 million meals, and the New York Times wrote this, and only delivered 50,000. So there's a lot of stories that are happening in Puerto Rico that it just, as a Puerto Rican born and raised, it's you know, we're not seeing the end of this, and it's been really, really heartbreaking. But on the other hand, this CR bill actually provided federal relief aid for Puerto Rico, about $11 billion Medicaid. It's definitely not the $90 billion that the governor of Puerto Rico was asking for, but at least that got passed in this current bill.
Julio, can you stay with us for a couple more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. Julio Ricardo Valera is the digital media director for Futuro Media, contributor to Latino USA, and co-host of the show In the Thick with Maria Hinojosa. We're also joined by David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And on today's Media Roundtable, we are talking about media coverage of Puerto Rico. You just heard Julio laying out so many of the issues that we should all be paying more attention to. Coming up after the break, we'll find out who are these private contractors, who is writing about them, and also who is pushing for privatization in Puerto Rico. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW. Local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. KLW is proud to be a media sponsor for Jad Abumrad as he comes to the stage of the Curran Theater in San Francisco tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Jad will unearth the hidden ingredients key to the stories that inspire, change, and connect us all. Tickets and information are at sfcurran.com.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it is our media roundtable. We are discussing media coverage of Puerto Rico. We're joined by David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept, and Julio Ricardo Valera, who's contributor to Latino USA and co-host of In the Thick. Before we let you go, Julio, you brought up a number of points before the break. Who in Puerto Rico is hiding information about deaths? Why is this happening?
That's a great question. It's being run by the Demographic Registry of the Department of Health, and overseen by the Secretary of Public Security. His name is Hector Pesquera. And ever since, you know, the CPI, Latino USA, published that story on December 7th, the New York Times published a story on December 8th, they were providing information to reporters. I got a couple of updates. They were responsive. Then on January 4th, when the governor of Puerto Rico announced a working group to look back at the hurricane-related deaths, that was the last data that was sent to reporters. So it's been close to a month. And when I find, and I actually talk to them, I email them probably two or three times a week, and about a week ago they finally responded and said, we're not going to share anything until the final working report is out. So we're talking about, the press, the public is not getting access to public, vital statistics. And they usually, normally these vital statistics come out and are shared with the public at the end of the year of each year, of each calendar year. And the fact that they're not out and we're into February is just, I don't know why they want to create this impression or this perception that they're not transparent, because I think there's issues of transparency, there's issues of trust now, there's issues of never taking accountability. They completely underestimated the death count. I mean, after that destruction, to say that there were 16 people, and when the President of the United States told the governor of Puerto Rico how many was a certified death, and he said 16 on national television, everyone in Puerto Rico was, they knew that that was just a political ploy. So it's a really, really serious issue that has impacted a lot of people, because it leads to questions of transparency and accountability.
Mm. And who is pushing for privatization?
The governor of Puerto Rico is, and his, I think it's sort of the, how best do I put it, the free enterprise neoliberal wings of the Democratic Party in Puerto Rico, or of the Statehood Party in Puerto Rico, people that are, deep business interests. This is, this rodeo has happened before. There's a history of this. When you have a private, when you have a public corporation, that which is PREPA, which is the Puerto Rican Public Utility, it was used political appointees. It was mismanaged. There's no vision for energy in Puerto Rico. So I think, the public utility has problems, but there's also skepticism in whether the fact that privatization is going to work, and those are the questions. And then people forget, the entire debt crisis is happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. And Puerto Rico, the people that actually run the finances of Puerto Rico is a fiscal control board right now. So you have a lot of players in a really complex situation. And the hurricane, I've always said this, will transform the island for the good or the better. But it's just, there's a lot of skepticism going on.
Well, we're going to have to do an entire hour on this. Julio, keep telling the truth. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Julio Ricardo Valera is digital media director for Futuro Media, contributor to Latino USA, and co-host of the podcast In the Thick. You can find more information about that and their work at yourcallradio.org. And joining us for the rest of the hour, David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept, author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And now I would like to welcome Zach Carter to the show. Zach is HuffPost's senior political economy reporter based in D.C. Hi, Zach. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, this morning I got yet another news alert about the stock market. I've received so many alerts throughout the week. There have been a lot of fluctuations, international headlines. The New York Times, the stock market is worried about inflation. Should it be? running through the commentaries is that the economy is doing great, wages are up, the Fed is going to increase the interest rate, and inflation is creating panic in the market. Zach, why do you think the stock market has become such a key indicator of the economy?
Oh, my, that is a terrifying question. You know, the stock market is almost synonymous with economics to most Americans. And it is, unfortunately, I think, well, maybe fortunately, really only tangentially related to the actual operation of most companies. It's you know, kind of incidentally related to the way that companies can raise capital to invest in, you know, new equipment or personnel or whatever it is that companies need to provide goods and services. But we have sort of come to take, since the 1970s, really, the market itself as a sort of, you know, measurement of the national health, almost. And it isn't. It's just not accurate to say that that's what it is or what's going on when people bid on stock prices one way or another. And I think if people want to know what's going on in the economy and how it works, they really do much better to read David's outstanding book, Chain of Title, than to follow the market commentary this week.
Well, we agree. I mean, what about that, David? According to some stats, 53% of Americans have no money in the stock market at all, including retirement accounts.
Right, right. And so looking at that as an indicator of overall American financial health is really silly. Zach is being too modest because he wrote a great piece called Everything You Should Know About the Stock Market, which I was going to liberally steal from throughout this hour, but now I can't because he's standing right there. So I will just agree with his remarks and say that the sort of entrails reading that you always get from people, stock analysts, when they try to decipher why the market is going up or down, should really be looked at with the same seriousness that you would look at palm reading. There really is no one reason that a stock market goes up or down that can be analyzed and deciphered in such a specific way. And everyone who tries to do it is just sort of flailing around, particularly in the modern market, which is driven by algorithmic trading so heavily. In other words, robots who are making the decisions to buy or sell based on an algorithm that's programmed into them. The idea that there's some sort of one-on-one relationship between whether it's wages or interest rates or anything like that and why stock markets rise and fall is just ludicrous.
Zach, in your piece, Everything You Should Know About the Stock Market, you point out that according to the People's Policy Project, the vast majority of stocks, 86%, are owned by the richest 10% of households. To the extent that the strange casino of the stock market does, in fact, create wealth, it almost exclusively circulates it among the rich. So why don't we hear about this when the media talk constantly about the stock market?
It's very strange, and you know, the media doesn't always talk constantly about the stock market. It's sort of something that springs up in the 1920s, and then after 1929, people have very skeptical views about the stock market in the United States. But starting in the 1980s, the Dow Jones Industrial Average started to be something that was quoted on the nightly news, and the performance of the stock market was seen as sort of a sign that things were going well. I think it corresponds to a general shift in corporate management philosophy that starts in the 1970s. It's really heavily influenced by economists like Milton Friedman, who instructed corporate leaders that, you know, in this idea that shareholder value is their sole and exclusive responsibility, that maximizing the share price is what corporations are supposed to do. You know, the share price doesn't necessarily correspond to anything that a company does. When a company's stock price goes up or down, it doesn't gain or lose money. Its operations are totally independent of what's happening in the stock market. And so if you create a lot of shareholder value, that's fine, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're making better cars or or that your finances are in some way meaningfully better than the company with a lower share price. So I think it's a little bit of a mystery why people take the stock market to be so fundamental, but it is the case that people do, and so when the stock market declines, there's this general perception among people who have the ability to make economic decisions at large institutions that you know the country is feeling kind of down and out, that the economy is not going in the right direction, and so people might legitimately pull back on investments or deny loans to, you know, otherwise productive businesses because the stock market declines, even though that doesn't necessarily respond to anything that's actually happening in the real world.
The other story the media seems to love, David, is how much money the wealthy lose when this happens. So from CNBC to the New Zealand Herald, Bloomberg, I mean, obviously all of the financial magazines, but USA Today, you know, here's how much Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and Jeff Bezos lost, billions lost as the Dow drops. They love those stories.
Right.
But when you look at the Dow, it did have a major drop. What are your thoughts on the underlying reasons for these huge drops? A lot of people are saying, well, is the bubble bursting now? What does this really mean?
Well, again, I think there's a lot of entrails reading, but you're absolutely right, first of all, in your initial statement, and you never hear, Warren Buffett made $100 billion today because the stock market went up X amount of points. That sort of gets pushed to the side. I would say, a sort of a general comment, two things. Number one, stock markets historically go up slightly, but in specific small increments, they go up and down and up and down and up and down. Maybe over time the trajectory is higher, but there are always large rises and falls. And what we know is that since the Great Recession, since around 2009, mid-2009, almost uninterrupted, this has been a bull market. So the idea that it was never going to go down was really just, you know, not based in reality. So at some point, this was going to happen. And you know, any trigger for it is just that, a trigger. It doesn't really correspond to anything happening in the economy. And that's number one. Number two, on the point that Zach was making about, you know, shareholder value, critically tied to that is the fact that executive compensation really changed in its mix, particularly in the 1990s, based on a measure passed by Bill Clinton that limited the tax treatment of executive compensation unless it was given in the form of stock. And as a result, executives started to hoard more and more of company stock and became aligned with shareholders in terms of this concept of deriving value. And that's where you got a series of episodes of financial engineering to sort of artificially prop up the stock, because the stock was not only important to shareholders to keep them happy, but also important to the bottom lines of the personal finances of these executives themselves. And so that alignment, I think, explains a good deal of why shareholder value and the stock market is seen as such a signal within corporate America.
And Zach, we are living in a time when top execs make 271 times more than workers. Oxfam does a lot of work on inequality. A new billionaire is created every other day. The three richest Americans have the same amount of wealth as the poorest half of the United States population. 82% of global wealth generated last year went to just 1% of the world's population. You and your colleagues cover these issues regularly. What do you think about overall coverage about inequality and stagnant wages, especially under Trump?
I think the reporters at HuffPost have been good and vigilant. I think Arthur Delaney and Daniel Maron at HuffPost are pretty aggressive about this. Dave Jamieson as well. Particularly since the tax bill passed, I thought our coverage was good. I think the idea that you want to tie the sort of social fortunes of the country to the productive engine or output of the economy and of the business world is not a bad idea. I think the idea that you want to do that through purchases of stock is really problematic. The idea that that we're going to get the most, you know, rational pricing and allocation of capital investment by linking it up to what's essentially a casino, it just strikes me as extremely implausible. But, you know, if business is doing great, the country, you know, ought to share in that. That's great. And, you know, I said in the piece, we could have business, you know, pay a special dividend into a public fund. And if we want, we can call the dividend a tax. The wealth that is created by the richest society in the history of rich society, you know, that's created by people going to work every day, and you know they should share in that that productivity. We shouldn't be having 10% of our households capturing 86% of that wealth.
To that point, we have an email from Mike in El Cerrito who says, are there other sources of employment and wage statistics that confirm those reported by the Department of Labor, or are those statistics unquestioned? Zach?
I mean, the Department of Labor is a very reliable source that gives great economic data. I mean, so is the census is a great source of economic data. I don't think there's a lot to be gained from questioning the official government statistics here. And, you know, if there were something wrong with statistics, it would be very confusing as to why they look so bad, and why they've looked so bad, you know, for several years now.
David?
Yeah, I would just add that there's absolutely no reason to question the statistics on wages and employment. What there is a reason to look at is the fact that those statistics are generally in aggregate. And when they're in aggregate, they do not account for the extreme breaking away of a few regions of the country in terms of prosperity and wealth and entrepreneurship relative to large swaths of the country which have been left behind. And what I'm talking about is really regional inequality, which can make some areas look like they're in recession, yet the overall aggregate statistics of the country looks like unemployment is quite low. So, I mean, that's something you, I think, have to take into account when you're looking at sort of overall statistics and how they relate to your personal situation.
David Dayan is a contributor to The Intercept, and Zach Carter is HuffPost's senior political economy reporter. I wanted to ask you both about a couple pieces you just wrote recently. David, you've got a piece for The Intercept called Senate Republicans Kept Provision to Fight High Drug Prices Out of a Spending Bill, according to Democrats. Can you tell us about this?
Well, this is really interesting. Up until really days before this budget agreement was passed, it was thought that this bipartisan bill called the CREATES Act would actually be put into the package. And what the CREATES Act would do was end a really egregious tactic on the part of pharmaceutical companies where they deny samples of their product to generic manufacturers once the patent for that brand name drug is completed. And this is a pure delay tactic to stop the generics from coming to market. And the generics need these samples so they can prove to the FDA that their product is equivalent to the brand name product. And it's just a delay tactic. And the CREATES Act would have really targeted that and would have brought a lot more generics into the marketplace, would have saved the government between $3.3 and $3.8 billion over 10 years, and it was taken out of the final bill at the behest of Senate Republicans. And what I've been told is that fleets of pharmaceutical executives were descending upon Washington, making sure that this, their top priority, was taken out of the bill. So this is an example of how, you know, we have heard from everybody in Washington on up to the president about how drug prices are unnecessarily high, that we have to get the prices of prescription drugs down. But the pharmaceutical lobby keeps winning over and over and over again. This is just the latest example.
And you report that that money, up to almost $4 billion, could have paid for more than a year of funding for state grants and prevention programs to combat the opioid epidemic, which continues.
Yeah, so that money is in the bill, but the CREATES Act, which could have, you know, offset that, didn't get in there. And let me just say, government budgeting aside, this would have saved consumers much more money than that $3.8 billion, because you're talking about generic alternatives to very pricey brand name prescription drugs.
David, what can you tell us about opioid treatment and money for that? Because we know that states across the country are having major budget crises in many cases, right, because of tax cuts. We're going to do a show actually about how education has been affected, where Oklahoma, many schools are now down to a 4-day-a-week school week.
Right.
NPR had a piece called "Trump Says He Will Focus on Opioid Law Enforcement, Not Treatment."
Right. So the money that's in this budget agreement for the opioid crisis, which is $6 billion over 2 years, is really the first major allocation of the entire Trump presidency to this crisis that is costing, you know, by one account, 64,000 lives per year.
Mm.
And if we had, you know, an attack on the country that cost us 64,000 lives per year, you can bet we would be giving more than $6 billion over 2 years to the military to make sure that didn't happen again. This $6 billion is woefully insufficient to deal with the opioid crisis, and the worst part is it's the only thing that's been done. Trump has been completely MIA on this crisis, outside of you know, having a commission set up a group of recommendations that subsequently weren't acted upon. This is, you know, one of the real lowlights of a presidency that many probably believe is littered with lowlights. And it's really an American tragedy that we are not doing, you know, we are not a DEFCON 1 on this thing that is causing such a huge disruption in so many lives.
Mm. The budget bill in the last couple, the last month, the media kind of report on this like a political football. Who's ahead? Who's behind? Oh, mm-hmm. Trump finally signed it. And you don't really hear about the details of the bill. I mean, this is a massive bill. Zach, what else can you tell us about the budget bill that Trump signed early this morning that is not getting much attention?
Oh, I can't tell you very much about the budget bill, unfortunately. I've been looking at stock markets, so
okay.
The actual details of the of the budget are somebody else is not supposed to do that. But the broad outlines are that the government is going to be spending more money to stay open, which is what it usually does. And most of the sort of political theater surrounding the budget has been derived from Republicans, alternately decrying or making excuses for going back on various promises about fiscal responsibility, which is a sort of ritual that you see every decade or so whenever Republicans hold power in Washington.
Right. David, what can you tell us? According to the New York Times, let's see, this is a trying to get the numbers right here.
Mm-hmm.
$300 billion in additional funds over 2 years for military and non-military programs. It would be nice to get those details. And then about $90 billion in disaster relief in response to the hurricanes and the wildfires last year.
Right. And what's incredible about that number is when you add it to the tax cuts, which, as we know, cost something on the order of $1.4 trillion over 10 years, in the next 2 years, there's going to be a fiscal stimulus coming from both government spending and tax cuts that's larger than the stimulus package of 2009, which happened at the depths of the largest recession in 80 years. It's quite remarkable. And, you know, I don't like to really, I mean, everyone in Washington's a hypocrite at some level, so I don't know that hypocrisy is the main thing you want to talk about here. But It is a remarkable statement that just you know, years out from the stimulus, we have a bigger stimulus that's coming in the form of this. But of course, that is in response to what was tremendous austerity over an extended period, which led to the lowest level of public investments in since the Eisenhower era. That's where we ended the Obama administration. And so this uptick, it was kind of a devil's bargain. You know, Republicans wanted to increase the military budget. Democrats wanted to get rid of the sequestration caps on the domestic budget. And so the compromise reach was, well, we'll just raise spending for both.
Mm.
And that's where we got to where we are. It's you know, as the thing to me that's most interesting about this budget deal is that a bunch of other tax breaks got snuck into it. Things that were really left for dead, tax benefits for thoroughbred racehorses and NASCAR tracks and Puerto Rican rum and things that were really thought to have been dead and buried were resurrected and made retroactive so that they'll be allowed to be taken in the 2017 tax year. It just shows that nobody in Washington wants to say no to a corporate lobbyist, and that's really what's driving decision making in Congress.
Do you have any idea what if there's money for the wall in this past budget?
No, not per se. That's what we have is an agreement to raise the caps. The actual authorization of the spending will come later. The budget deal extends the current level of spending for another month until March. And then it says, well, what we can do is raise the caps in the future for the next 2 years.
Hmm.
The appropriators still have to figure out what specific program gets what money. And so that will be done over the next month. And at that point, we will figure out what the priorities are in terms of the wall, as you mentioned, or other immigration or infrastructure or anything like that.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this. We should say that Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris did not vote for that budget bill. David Dayan is a contributor to The Intercept and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And Zach Carter is HuffPost's senior political economy reporter. Thank you both for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.